Welcome back to the Crash Course Podcast. My name is Craig Crash Collins, joined as always by Brandon Scott, otherwise known as B Scott. We got a lot to get into, really a lot going on in the state of Indiana. We had some breaking news today that we'll get to here in a moment. We're going to talk a little bit of IndyCar. We're going to, as you know, of course, best month of the year getting underway as of right now. And then, of course, we're going to talk about the Pacers drama, which has just been absolutely insane. But B Scott, what's funny is that we sat here on this podcast last week and we were just, I mean, we evaluated the draft. I mean, this, the breaking news that happened today, you know, doesn't change our mood of the draft, but definitely kind of puts a better light on the offseason that the Colts have had this year.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, the breaking news, by the way, is that Pro Bowl left tackle Eric Fisher has signed a 1-year, $9.4 million contract with the Colts. That is the perfect contract for somebody that is coming off of an Achilles injury. They are reporting out of the Colts camp that the medicals coming back look like, at least sources coming out of the Colts camp, that the medicals are coming back on Eric Fisher and that he should be ready to go in September at the end of training camp, if not early October then. So I think it's a great move, to be honest with you. This is exactly what we talked about last week, that this was an area of need. And hey, I guess if they did not have any of the other the tackles in the draft that highly evaluated and they had a feeling they were going to be able to land Eric Fisher, you know what? I'll take the former number one overall pick every day of the week over an unproven commodity at that point, over a prospect. You know, obviously he's not going to be the long-term answer right now. I know he's only on a 1-year contract, but it's kind of a, you know, you're coming off of an injury. Let's see what you got. You know, it's not anything binding for the long-term. You know, it's going to be tough, I believe, next year for them to draft the tackle because not having a first round pick will be, make things difficult. But if he comes out and performs well, he's only, I think he's what, 30, 31. He's about my age. He's younger than me, which is surprising. Not really. I'm old. Everybody's younger than me. but I feel like Eric Fisher, I mean, I feel like we watched Eric Fisher in college.
He is 30 years old. He is only about a month older than me. So
yeah, we actually did watch him in college.
Yeah.
Because he's out of Central Michigan.
Yes.
Because it was a big deal when a Mac player went number one overall. And we thought we were going to get it again with Khalil Mack. Came close. But, you know, I think it's a prove it deal health-wise, really. It's not talent-wise. We all know he's a talented player. So this could be one of those types of deals where it's very similar to like a Philip Rivers type contract, even though he had a 2-year deal. And I love this move. This, I think, you know, the offensive line has been a plus, probably one of the better units for the Colts. With the departure of Anthony Costanzo, it was still going to be a strong unit, but it wasn't going to be nearly as strong at one of the cornerstone positions of left tackle being the blind side protection for Carson Wentz. When, you know, if you got a quarterback that, like I said last week, if you got a quarterback that's got the yips and is, you know, struggling with confidence, you want somebody to protect his blind side. And if he feels comfortable and, you know, he can stand in the pocket and not force anything, that's a great signing. And for under 10 million, I'm sure there's probably roster bonuses that we don't know about. This is just the high overview. I'm sure there's like, hey, you play this amount, you'll get a bump, you know, these types of things. I'm sure they're written in the contract, but still, for a base salary of under 10 million for a Pro Bowl tackle that, you know, he is getting up there in age, but I would still say he's kind of in his prime, that doesn't have a big injury history. It's just, this is his injury and it's a big injury. And he seems to be recovering from it very well. So the Colts, I know the Colts and Chris Ballard would not have signed him if the medicals didn't come back showing that he was going to be okay from it, especially when there was another guy in Charles Leno sitting right out there as well. So I think overall, though, this is the best possible scenario for the Colts at left tackle.
Yeah, I'm with you. I when we the news first broke earlier today, and you know,
you broke it to me. That's rare.
Yeah, exactly. I dude, honestly, when I saw it, when it like flashed across my screen, I was like, okay, all right. I went to Twitter to find the tweet so I could retweet it. That Adam Schefter put it out. You know, because I was pumped up about it. And then I was like, ooh, you know what? I'm gonna see if I can get to this before B Scott messages me, because typically B Scott's the one sending me links from Twitter and stuff. And so yeah, I sent that over to B Scott, and we all had a moment of elation because we're very excited. I think this was kind of the missing piece. Like I said, I mean, you know, it kind of puts a little bit more perspective on why Ballard drafted the way that he did. It shows that like he didn't have, again, like you said, he didn't have the other tackles rated maybe as highly as he did those other players that they ended up taking. And I mean, you know, you would have liked, if this was going to happen, would have happened in reverse order. You would have liked to have gotten Fisher before the draft and be like, all right, this kind of, now this, we can just kind of kick back. And
I honestly believe that's a little bit of Ballard. You know, let's be honest. He and Eric Fisher have been talking. They knew this was coming. And had Ballard signed Fisher prior to the draft, I think this was almost a bit of a strategical move, because then everybody would be like, okay, well, the Colts now obviously are not going to take a left tackle. You know, we don't have to make a run on them before the Colts pick.
Yeah.
So, you know, that may leave their other the other targets the Colts had may have been taken, because other teams, you know, were like, oh, you know, we really would like a Christian Darrisaw or whatever. And I don't know, maybe, you know, that's just the kind of the way he works. Like you've said before, Chris Ballard's playing 4D chess while we're playing regular chess.
Right.
And it's proven it yet again.
Yeah. And honestly, I mean, you get an opportunity to add a Super Bowl winning left tackle to your team. I mean, and that's the thing that we were worried about.
Already with a Hall of Fame offensive lineman as your offensive, as one of your offensive line coaches.
Right.
Come on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this was one of the points of, you know, contention when the Colts got Wentz, was like, how healthy is he going to be? And how, you know, are they going to keep him upright? How is this not going to be Andrew Luck 2.0? I mean, not to that extreme. I mean, like you said, it still would have been,
because the offensive line is better than it was then. I mean, that was like,
well, I mean, it's the reverse of what happened to the Eagles. The Eagles went from a good offensive line to a terrible offensive line. The Colts went from a terrible offensive line to a good offensive line. And we've seen, and that's kind of the point I was getting to, you know, I've mentioned it in the past that like what made Carson Wentz so great in that 2017 season where he really popped off, was the fact that he was behind a great offensive line. And that's what the Colts now have by getting Fisher. You know, you feel a lot better, you know, knowing that they addressed the left tackle position this way. Because I mean, honestly, after the last couple of, you know, after this offseason, the Fisher signing is great. And after the fact, we can sit here and be like, oh man, that's just Chris Ballard doing it again. But I mean, there's no guarantees. I know you and I were like, are they really going to have Sam Tevy as their starting left tackle day one?
Oh yeah. Even Dan Dockich today, he came out and said, yeah, they weren't running it back with Sam Tevy or Julian Davenport or Chaz Green. No, you're not doing that. And so going out and signing this actually potentially could put the Colts in that echelon with the Kansas City Chiefs, because honestly, in my opinion, if he can return back to his form, which I believe that the medicals are there and they wouldn't have signed him if they don't believe that he could. I honestly believe having Eric Fisher and Anthony Costanzo, actually Eric Fisher's younger than Anthony Costanzo, so upgrade there in age. But I honestly do believe in a talent level, this is a huge upgrade. So we already had a really good offensive line. I think this now takes the offensive line to great, and having it at another Pro Bowler on your line, along with your Pro Bowl center, your Pro Bowl left guard, that basically that left side is going to be solid. And that's going to rub off then on the right side as well, where Braden Smith is, you know, getting better and better every year. And you don't hear about when Braden Smith's name doesn't come up in a game, you don't want your name coming up in a game as an offensive lineman, because that means you're either letting you're letting defensive players go by, or you're getting penalties called on you,
right?
Or you're Quentin Nelson and you're just blowing up a linebacker. But that's different. And but you never hear Braden Smith or Mark Glowinski. So, you know, that right side is solid as well. I just believe this is a bigger upgrade than people really believe, because obviously he's recovering from a torn Achilles, and that's a big deal. But still, this, I think, takes the Colts offensive line to the next level, and that makes the run game even scarier.
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that, because I was going to say what's kind of getting lost in this whole conversation is the fact that, I mean, they run it back with Marlon Mack and Jonathan Taylor.
And
you have that great offensive line. I mean, you know, they're going to be taking the pressure off of Wentz. Wentz won't have to throw, you know, 40 times a game. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
this is not Andrew Luck 2.0 because of that run game.
Right. So, I mean, it's going to be really fun to watch. Yeah. Now, you know, not that I was out on the, like, you know, feeling any like bad, anything bad about the Colts after the draft. I just was very confused. But now after this signing, I'm back in a little bit. I'm back locked and loaded, back in the Chris Ballard camp. You know, I had 1 foot like kind of on that threshold a little bit. And then like, it wasn't not even the full shoe length outside. I was just kind of like, starting to like, maybe we should.
I had the door open. Had the door open. I was like, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave.
And now he's got me back in. So yeah. I'm ready. I'm excited to see what the season holds.
If you want to take the reports out of the rookie minicamp from this past weekend, which take those things with a grain of salt, because that's the PR department, the social media department spinning things the way they need to spin them. Apparently, Quiddy Pay was in full-blown attack mode and was extremely impressive.
Yeah.
We're a week removed from the draft to that rookie camp, and you know, you gotta hype up the play. What are they else? Are they
right.
gonna say,
man, yeah, I was gonna say, man, you know what? He really was slow, looked out of shape. We are not looking good after that big voice.
This is not gonna end well for us. I mean, this guy makes Bjorn Werner look like a Pro Bowler.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, but I'm back in. I'm back excited for the Indianapolis Colts. So we'll see what that holds for them. Now, you know, obviously we have a very Indianapolis themed show. We're gonna get now into the month of May. But before we
you do with your background. I don't know. I'm down here in the man cave wearing my Ohio State sweater.
You have stood pat with the exception of last year's draft, where you had like Cliff Kingsbury's, I think, draft. Room background, yeah. Like with the man, you had that last year. Ever since then, you've rocked it with that man cave. And honestly, I will tell you this, like a couple times, like you'll get up and like I'll see like the couch behind you, but like I think mentally have convinced myself that that is your actual like man cave. Like
that you've been in my house before,
right? I know it doesn't exist, but I'm like, oh yeah, that's not his actual.
You know, this man cave is like the size of my house.
Right, exactly. So we're going to get into the Indy 500, but the all the hubbub that goes into the pageantry of the month of May and the Indy 500 as we get set for that here in just a moment. Before that, let's get a word from our friends of the show.
Are you tired of your same old lunch hour of sitting and scrolling through your apps on your smartphone? Have you thought about playing a board game with your coworkers? Eat Lunch and Board Game is a podcast dedicated to telling you about board games that are great for lunchtime fun, and some that are probably better saved for after work hours. I've been playing games at my office for over 4 years now, where I have made new friends and business connections that have been very useful. Board games build bridges.
All right, so like we alluded to earlier on at the beginning of the podcast, May is finally here, which, of course, it was May last week when we did the podcast too, but we are now finally getting
Racing
ready.
May is here.
Exactly. We are finally getting ready for the month of May at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We're very excited. We're doing our best to talk racing at least once every week leading up to the 500. We're very excited, you know, for the 500 this year. And so let's go ahead and kind of catch you guys up. We had our after the race at Barber, we had our kind of, you know, predictions and first race analysis, but a couple races have happened since then. So let's go ahead and get you guys caught up. Obviously you guys know, if you've watched the previous podcast, that Alex Palou won the season opener at Alabama. The Firestone Grand Prix of St. Pete was, I believe, the following weekend. Colton Herta absolutely dominates at St. Pete, leads 97 of 100 laps en route to victories. Colton Herta his fourth victory of his career. Then
I think
last,
he's like one away now, one away, or did he tie? I think he tied his dad.
Maybe I'm not sure exactly, but. But
I forget
maybe
what it was, but they were making a big deal about it.
Well, I was going to say, because that's kind of crazy, because his dad was in the league a long time, I think, wasn't he? And yeah.
I think
so
he got like five. I think he's one. They're predicting he'll get to five quicker than his dad did.
Yeah, I think he will too. And then we had, of course, the doubleheader at Texas, and we want to talk about dominating. In the Genesis 300, Scott Dixon leads 206 of 212 laps, absolutely shows them how it's done. Scott McLaughlin, Pato O'Ward, Alex Palou, and Graham Rahal rounded out the top five. Then in the Expel 375, the race got started off with a pretty big crash on the opening lap, six cars involved, including Sebastian Bourdais and Alexander Rossi. I feel like Alexander Rossi's in a little bit of a rut.
You know, here. Yeah, I was just going to say that. You got to talk about Rossi and how he's just, the past couple seasons, he just seems to struggle. If it's not the Indy 500, he's just not recently in it.
Yeah,
last year, even in the Indy 500, he just wasn't. I mean, he wrecked.
Right.
Yeah, he didn't even finish the Indy 500 last year. So I wonder what's going on there. There's something.
Yeah, I mean, he's the Andretti Autosport,
really,
right?
All the Andretti cars outside of Florida, but all the Andretti cars just seem to be off.
I was going to say, because he was kind of the, like, after, you know, after, of course, the heyday of Andretti Autosport, like, he was getting them kind of back on the map with how well he was running, and now he's kind of faltered a little bit.
Takuma won it with Rahal.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The first time he won it with Andretti.
Did he?
Yeah, his second one was with Rahal.
I gotcha. Yeah. So
back years for Andretti.
Right. Big crash on the opening lap of the Expel 375. Dixon picked up just where he left off in the first race, though. He leads 163 laps. For the total on the weekend, he led 369 laps at Texas. So basically, you know, if you were at any of those races in Texas or you're watching on TV, he basically just, you know, was might as well have been the pace car, because he was out in front of the field so much. And then there was 12 lead changes among nine drivers, so a little bit more of a competitive race than the first one. Pato O'Ward takes the lead on lap 225 from Joseph Newgarden and does not look back. It's the first IndyCar win for O'Ward. Joseph Newgarden, Graham Rahal, Scott Dixon, and Colton Herta rounded out the top five. So looking at the point standings, Scott Dixon right now leads. He's got 153 points on the season. Pato O'Ward is 22 back of him in second. 26 points in third is Alex Palou. Joseph Newgarden is 37 points back in fourth. And Graham Rahal is in fifth, 46 points behind Scott Dixon. So next up, as we've alluded to, it's the GMR Grand Prix, Grand Prix of Indianapolis. This will be the seventh year that this kind of kicks off the month of May. And I'm excited for it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. You know, talk about surprises on the
rain. Calling for rain.
Yeah, that's never good. But we'll see.
Not good for Scott Dixon.
No. but, you know, talking about
good for Simon Pagenaud.
Right. Yeah. I mean, heck, we're going to see a repeat of what we've seen so far, in the IndyCar Grand Prix. Is it's either, you know, flip a coin between Will Power and Simon Pagenaud, and that's who you're going to see probably cross the finish line first. But talking about surprises on the season so far, you know, what's really, exciting for me and what I've kind of noticed, you know, looking back on the season so far in IndyCar is just all the new challengers emerging. We talked about Rossi earlier. Usually when we're talking about the championship and contenders and drivers doing well, we're talking, you know, obviously we're talking Scott Dixon. He's of course there, but we're talking Alexander Rossi. We're talking Joseph Newgarden. Now we've got, you know, guys like Alex Palou, who's got two top fives on the season, just had one last year. Of course, that win at Alabama. Colton Herta wins at St. Pete. He's got two top fives this season. And then Pato O'Ward, who's you know, already halfway to what his total was last year as far as top fives with three. He had six all of last year and got, of course, the win at Texas. So, I mean, you know, we have some guys that have been on the circuit for a while. I mean, you know, 2020, I think, was the first year for Palou and Award, right? Or was it – do I have it backwards? I know Herta was 2018. I think maybe Pato Award might have been 2018 as well. But we've got some guys – we've got some guys who have been – and not haven't really been in the league a long time who are starting to kind of take shape as the new guys to kind of challenge the guys like Dixon and those at the front that we're kind of used to seeing. So I'm really – really surprised by that, really excited for that, of course, because that just makes the sport that much more interesting when you have your normal challengers, the guys you're used to seeing up there at the front, and now these new guys that are kind of starting to get into their prime. And then also, I mean, not that we should be surprised that Scott Dixon dominated Texas, but just in the way that he did. Just the fact that he led 370 laps, essentially, you know, rounded up. I mean, I know you don't do that, but we'll do it anyway. I mean, just led so many laps of that rate of, you know, that weekend, basically what, I mean, quick math here, probably around like what, 75% of the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
So that's just insanity when you think about it in those terms.
Yeah. I think for me, the biggest surprise, one of them is Alex Palou. I think, you know, you saw the glimpses last year with the equipment that just wasn't up to par with everybody else. And then getting him into a Ganassi car and really, you know, giving him that opportunity. I don't think we expected him to come out and win week one. I think, you know, over time you were going to see him get better. So to see him performing as well as he is, he's one of those, he's a very aggressive driver. He drives hard and but he's a smart driver too. The other one for me, you know, I'm not going to say Colton Herta is a big surprise because now, you know, he's switched over to Andretti full time. We know what he's capable of. I'm not even going to really say Pato Award because he was knocking on the door a lot last year. And with Schmidt-Peterson merging with or basically getting – joining McLaren. I mean, McLaren's got the money to put into the program and have them contend. So I'm not too surprised about that because Zach Brown does not like to lose. If you've ever watched the Drive to Survive series on Netflix, you know, Zach Brown is a big time. He loves to win. And, you know, being an American, he's got to really hold his own, especially over in the F1. But the other big surprise for me kind of lays within Penske. There's two parts to it. One, Scott McLaughlin going out in his first oval race and doing as, or his second oval race and do, or his first, yeah, his first one and doing as well as he did. Was it, did he get, I got to scroll back up. I'm getting my races confused. It was, yeah, it was the first race at Texas where he finished, I think second or third, but you know, that's surprising because Texas is not an easy track for a rookie that's never run an oval before. That's not easy. So to see him do that well, that bodes really well. But I think the other biggest surprise on the Penske side of things is just how poorly Will Power and Simon Pagenaud have run this year. They just seem off, you know. It's been really surprising. You know, it's not surprising. Like, okay, the first races of the year, Scott McLaughlin's running near the back. Well, he's figuring out the car. You know, Joseph Newgarden's up at the front. No surprise, except for Barber, obviously. Yeah. But just to see Will Power and Simon Pagenaud running just really not in contention is surprising, especially with both of them looking to, you know, Penske's looking at dropping down to three cars. He's also said that he's willing to run four, but if he drops down to three, that leaves one of them on the outside looking in, because obviously it's not going to be Joseph Newgarden, and you just signed Scott McLaughlin, so you're not really doing anything there. You're not going to drop him. So it's either Pagenaud or Power. And right now, neither one of them is really like showing that it needs to be me. It needs to be me that stays. You know, so that's a little confusing and a little concerning as well. But those are my biggest surprises, I would say, at this point.
Yeah, you know, and that's what kind of adds an extra storyline going into this weekend, is because we've alluded to a little bit before that, you know, Will Power and Simon Pagenaud, I mean, this is their race. So, I mean, if this, you know, if there was a weekend where one of them or both of them, you know, kind of, you know, got a kick in the rear and put it back into full force, you know, it would be this weekend. But yeah, I like where you're going with that, because, you know, it is kind of odd. You know, I didn't think about it until you brought it up, the fact that, like, yeah, I mean, Penske, aside from, you know, Newgarden, who, you know, has gone from wrecking week one all the way to fourth, and then McLaughlin, who's done all right, you know, we're not used to seeing, like, Pagenaud and Will Power struggling like they are. And, I mean, you know, I'm trying to think of, like, which one would you really choose? I mean, you know, what would be interesting is if whoever gets cast aside, if they ended up, you know, we talked about Andretti's struggles. I mean, not doing a little bit of an off-season, you know, discussion here. But, I mean, could maybe one of them end up with Andretti to kind of revitalize that organization a little bit? Although I don't know who you kick out there. So, yeah, it is odd to see not
– Ryan Hunter-Reay.
Yeah, maybe.
No, he brings in DHL money.
That's
he
true.
He's in the DHL, man. He's not going anywhere.
So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, it does kind of add a big question mark as to, you know, what's going to happen with those other two Penske guys.
Yeah, that was a big storyline coming into the season, is how are they going to perform, because somebody's on the chopping block. And I do believe it's also contract time for them as well.
So, yeah, we'll definitely see what happens with those guys. But, yeah, I mean,
you know, a big measuring stick is definitely just the whole month of May for that team is going to be a big measuring stick. Now, obviously, you can not much as much with Scott McLaughlin, just because, you know, that's a lot to put on a rookie.
You have to win the Indy 500 or you're out.
You know, with Will Power and Simon Pagenaud both being former 500 winners, they need to be up there in contention. Now, obviously, I feel like the pressure is going to be on Joseph Newgarden, just because he wants to win it bad. And he hasn't yet. And he's been so close a couple of times here recently.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be self-imposed pressure more so than team pressure for him. But Pagenaud and Power need to have good months of May, because right now they're not showing anything that is worthy of keeping them at Penske.
Yeah, because isn't Power like ninth in the point standings right now? He's pretty far back there.
Yeah.
Something like that. And I mean, and that gets us perfectly into our predictions in hot or cold. This year's winner of the GMR Grand Prix will be someone other than Will Power or Simon Pagenaud. Will Power has won it three times. Simon Pagenaud has won it three times. And this is the seventh season of the GMR Grand Prix. But I will say this, I'm going to say it's a cold take. And here's why. Both have combined, you know, we talked about their struggles. Both have combined for two top fives this season, one apiece, and have led a total of five laps this season. Dixon broke the mold of the Power Pagenaud debacle back on July 4th weekend. Of course, that's adding races. You know, there were three total at the IMS road course last year. And then guess who got a win back in that doubleheader weekend is Will Power. So Will Power's won four times on the Indianapolis road course. Joseph Newgarden was the other winner who kind of broke the mold.
He had a good – that second race was a really good race for him. I was there, and he had good strategy with his tires, and so
– yeah.
And it was kind of rainy and cold that day too, so – kind of good simulation for what it could be like this weekend.
Right. So of like the nine races, however many races have been at the Indianapolis road course, you know, Will Power and Simon Pagenaud account for seven, and then Dixon and Newgarden. So, I mean, it looks like, you know, like I said, it should be a weekend where Power and Pagenaud, you know, one of those two drivers, if not both, can kind of rebound a little bit. But my prediction for who's going to win is going to be Joseph Newgarden. He's got two top fives this season. His most recent was, of course, finishing second at Texas, did not lead any laps. But he's got no fewer than three wins a season since 2016. And I think that he gets on track to continue his winning ways this weekend at the, you know, GMR Grand Prix. You alluded to how well he ran at the Harvest GP last year. So I think he picks up right where he left off there. You know, I talked about how he was going to be my championship prediction this year. You know, and how he does have a knack of, you know, like I said, three or four victories, you know, I think it was three in 2017 and then four the rest of the way up until this year. He hasn't got a win yet. And I mean, obviously I know that he would rather have the second race of this month as a win, but hey, why not both, as they say. So I think Joseph Newgarden is going to win this weekend at the GMR Grand Prix.
Yeah, I believe it's a cold take as well, just because they just power and Pagenaud, like I said, just something's off there with them this year. Yeah, Joseph Newgarden's a good pick. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to see Scott Dixon up there running well as well. I mean, it's Dixon. Let's just be honest.
Right.
But my pick, honestly, is going to be Jack Harvey. Jack Harvey's always run really, really well at the GMR Grand Prix or on the road course in Indianapolis. So I think his time is going to come. And I think Jack Harvey pulls off the win this weekend at the GMR Grand Prix. And I'm excited for it. If that happens, I'll be very happy for Jack Harvey.
Look at you going kind of off the reservation there, not, you know.
Yeah, it's off reservation.
I mean, as far as like
how he runs at this track, it wouldn't be surprising.
No, I mean, as far as just not going with like maybe a household name, you win. Oh, yeah. That's what I mean by off the reservation. But it was a very B. Scott pick. It was very well thought out, and I like it. So I like that pick.
I don't know. There's a lot of like experts that are picking Jack Harvey this weekend too. So I don't know if it's like I can't take too much credit of being creative and, you know, when.
Well, why would you say that, B. Scott? You could have just taken all the credit and walked away, but
you gotta give credit where credit's due.
You're just too humble of a guy. But yeah, very excited. And of course, like I said, we're gonna be talking about you know, the month of May, all May. We're gonna be talking about IndyCar, gonna try to work it into the conversation every week. So I'm excited for the GMR Grand Prix, and we'll see if either one of us is right on our prediction of who will come away with the victory.
I think one of us will be right. I'll say that. I believe that one of us will be right. One of our picks will win.
Okay. I like that. So just a quick reminder before we get into our final topic of the night, that you can listen to us every week on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever podcasts can be heard. You can hear the Crash Course Podcast. If you want to look us up on Facebook, Crash Course Podcast, at Crash Course FM on Twitter. And then of course, 3C Media on YouTube. That's where you can catch the MCT podcast. Those guys are absolutely killing it. I made an appearance this past weekend. We got a lot of baseball talk over there, as well as you know, talking about the Aaron Rodgers saga as that kind of unfolds a little bit. And then also you can catch the you know, the video side of things for the Crash Course Podcast. And if you want to watch us live, twitch.tv/3cmedia, go over there, watch us as we record, give us your input. Speaking of input, Dusty in the chat, he asks, what do you think of Tim Tebow coming back? I'm excited that he gets an opportunity to play. And it's, you know, I almost tweeted this out, and actually I'm glad you asked that question, Dusty, because I wanted to tweet this out, but I didn't know how to phrase it without sounding like a jerk. And so I didn't send it, because I was like, I mean, not that it would have mattered. I don't think anybody would have cared, but like,
Twitter.
I cared. So, yeah. So, but
jerks out there on Twitter.
That is very true. But I feel sorry for Tim Tebow, and not in like the condescending way. And that's why I thought it might like come off as like someone would read that and be like, well, screw you. He doesn't need you to feel sorry for him. He's, you know, made millions of dollars and he's on TV and whatnot. I'm like, no, I just feel bad in the sense that like, he wants to be a pro athlete so bad, and he's good enough to
go athletic.
Right, exactly. He's so good, and you know, he wanted to be a quarterback, and all the reason he was kind of kicked out of that was because he throws really funny fun. and he's got a
so
lot of
Phillip
fanfare.
Rivers. So did yeah. Phillip Rivers.
Right. And he had a lot of fanfare around him, you know, because of the whole Tebow time and that kind of thing. And then
not like he asked for it. He did not ask for that.
Right. He wasn't doing it. Yeah. He wasn't doing it to draw attention. You know, it's funny because I see that meme sometimes, you know, thrown around on Facebook of like, you know, people thinking that Tim Tebow got kicked out of the league because of, you know, the fact that he prayed. I was like, no, he didn't get kicked out because of that. He got kicked out because, you know, he threw funny and the teams that had him were like, well, we don't want the media circus around, so we're going to kick him out. It wasn't because specifically because he was praying. It was just because
the media circus. I never understood it. Like,
it's because of of course his religion. It every time that he led a comeback, it was divine intervention.
Funny is how many guys at the draft last week got up and said, first of all, I want to thank God. Without him, I wouldn't be in this position.
Right, but it's
they're not going to be a media circus around him. And how many times have we seen a wide receiver or a running back that get into the end zone, drop down to one knee like they're praying, and they point to the sky? How many times? Several times, and there's no media circus surrounding it. But because he was such a big name, and he did that.
Because he was very, I want to say outspoken, because that has a negative connotation, but because because he was so open and that made up so much of who he was.
In a family of missionaries. Right.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's the reason why I think that, because I mean the eye black with the Bible verses running down to the end zone, apart from the team, not saying that he was trying to make it a spectacle, but I'm just saying apart from the team, you'd run down, take a knee. I don't know. I just think that's
And what's funny is that in today's college football at Purdue, or anytime I go to a Purdue football game, the team comes running out of the locker room, I would say 80% of the players run down to the end zone, take a knee, and they pray, and they get back up. No different than Tim Tebow did. But for some reason, when Tim Tebow did it, it was this huge deal.
Right.
Huge deal.
So, yeah, and then, of course, he goes to, Major League Baseball, which that was going to, be a kind of weird, thing to work out. I think it would have been better if he would have just gone to the Rays. I think that would have made a lot more sense, just because you would have just had, or the Marlins, you would have just been, that Florida connection. But
never understood the Mets.
Yeah, well, and the thing is too,
of all teams, the Mets.
The weird. Hey, got him at Carton MLB the Show last year, so I was really excited about that. But it's a thing where because of his age, he was never going to get a long-term big contract. He was never going to, So, because of the service time, he would never have gotten enough. By the time he got enough service time to be eligible to pick wherever he wanted to go free agency wise, he would be 35, 36, and they'd be like, all right, well, here's your little, 2-year contract for, $15 million. The money wouldn't have been.
I would love a 2-year contract for $15 million.
Right.
All day.
I will be now the
left fielder for the Mets. Contract for $2 million.
Right. He was never going to sign a big deal. He never would have gotten Tatis or Machado money anyway, but he never would have gotten any sort of big, long-term lucrative contract. What's funny is too, when he finally got released by the Mets, he was actually starting to figure it out, I think.
That's the Mets for you.
Right. So,
somebody's figuring it out. Gotta go.
Right.
Gotta go.
That's not the Mets way. I'm glad, especially because he gets paired with Urban Meyer, because getting paired with Urban Meyer, he's a guy who understands Tebow. He knows how to utilize his skill set. And hey,
be a wildcat type quarterback.
Right. I was going to say
they're going to work him into them.
Remember when Florida won the national championship with his freshman year, that's how they used him. It was Chris Leak was the main quarterback, and they used Tim Tebow to do those jump passes in a wildcat formation. So I think that's going to be a really good – he could be basically Taysom Hill, because Taysom Hill's listed as a tight end too. So, it's going to be
he's really listed as a tight end? I just thought he would be a utility.
No, dude.
Or as they put it in college terms, athlete.
Right.
It in college. We don't know where you really play.
Taysom Hill was broken this year, because in that week or two where he was the starting quarterback, I did this. I was one of those scumbags in my fantasy league that picked him up, slotted him in as a tight end, and used him as basically a second quarterback and got double the quarterback points. So, yeah, he's listed as a tight end, but when he played quarterback, you could have started him at tight end, and then like a week later, ESPN changed the rule and was like, no, he's now just a quarterback until he goes back to tight end. So I think I'm excited to see how they utilize his skill set. I think it's a good match. I don't think it will end as like disappointingly as it ended with the Mets and with of
is
course
it
the
be
first
a difference maker.
Probably know. Not. But
I
it's gonna
know.
Be.
It might be. I mean, look, yeah. It's Urban Meyer. Who knows?
Right. So,
it's
but
also
I'm just
going to give Urban Meyer another option at quarterback if, say, Lawrence doesn't, you know, has any struggles.
Right.
He's a good locker room guy.
Oh yeah.
Who knows Urban Meyer that can help out these players? I mean, look, how many players did Urban Meyer draft or sign that are his former college players? He's going to have two tight ends that he's coached.
Yeah.
Tim Tebow. And then he drafted Luke Farrell out of Ohio State.
Yeah. So, I mean, and then didn't he coach against Trevor Lawrence in one of the college football playoffs, or has it been too long?
No,
yeah.
No, he's never, cause it was Ryan Day.
Okay. I didn't know if he was ever there for any of those games. So,
or what, wasn't there a year where Ohio State got absolutely thumped?
But I'm trying to think of like when that crosses over with Deshaun Watson. So I don't know when that officially.
I'm pretty sure it was Trevor Lawrence. They never played against Deshaun Watson.
Yeah. Well, are you sure? Because the first, I think the first Clemson Alabama year they went through Ohio State, didn't they?
No, because Ohio State did not make the.
No, because Clemson went through Oklahoma that year. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So, anyway, maybe once he coached against Trevor Lawrence. So, you get kind of that whole thing. So, yeah, I'm excited to see what happens with Tim Tebow.
Yeah, me too.
All right. So, yeah, let's go ahead and go over into our talk about the Indiana Pacers. Because it's funny, we haven't talked Pacers in a while because they really haven't warranted us to talk about them because they've been very bad, very up and down this year. And they've, you know, had a lot of injuries and they weren't probably going to make the playoffs. So we're probably going to tie a little like our podcast next week before all this drama broke, probably would have been the first time we talked about them. We're probably going to tie a nice little bow on the season and then just go about, you know, our regular scheduled programming. I don't know how to talk. But we get a Bleacher Report article from Jake Fisher last week in which Adrian Wojnarowski reports that IU coach Nate Bjorkgren may be gone after this season. There's reports that the team chemistry is crumbling, that he has an aggressive and abrasive communication style, that he micromanages the team. TJ Warren requested a trade upon Bjorkgren getting hired. And you know, for those of you who don't know, Bjorkgren was from the Phoenix Suns, where TJ Warren was prior to his Pacers days. And it's reported that the Pacers brass didn't really do their background work on Bjorkgren, just talked basketball. So honestly, I'm a little stunned, because we've seen we've definitely seen the Pacers miss on head coaching hires before, but it's always been from a basketball standpoint. It's always been because they just didn't get the performance on the court they were looking for. And so, all right, well, we're going to go ahead and, you know, part ways, but never have we seen it on this sort of scale. The amount of turmoil that's going on, you know, it's not just he couldn't get, you know, the job done on the court. It's a culture issue. Which is really crazy. And it's odd that in the Pacers' attempt to catch up with the rest of the league as far as, you know, play style, you know, I didn't realize the Pacers were like last in 3-point shooting under Nate McMillan. You know, in their attempt to kind of, you know, catch up with the rest of the league, they get someone who is not great at dealing with how the league works, because as much as you and I may not like it at times, the league is very player driven. And so, you know, when I, you know, first looked at the story, I was like, this is crazy for even an NFL coach where the players don't kind of run things. And, you know, cause I mean, if this story comes out and, you know, that Frank Reich was this way, you know, you'd think, okay, he's just trying to be the next Bill Belichick, you know, whatever. He's just trying to be, you know, a hard ass. But I mean, this is, you know, a league
more than that.
Right. this is a league where you like have to make sure your players are well taken care of. You have to, I mean, not to say that the others aren't, but it's a situation where the players more or less run things. And so if you're not making them happy, if you're not doing what you can, you know, on that end of things, then it is going to be a culture issue and it is going to collapse in on you. So it's kind of funny and ironic that they were trying to catch up with the league and then actually took kind of a step back with a guy who's like, you know what? I know you guys are typically used to kind of having things your way and looked at, you know, from your point of view, but it's all about me. I'm going to micromanage everything and well, you know, run
it's
things.
Not
like
even that. It's the fact that he pulled the wool over the front office's eyes in his job interview.
Right.
Well, and also I put some blame on the front office as well. Like, you got to look at more than just the X's and O's when you're dealing with a coach. I know that's a big, 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 big part of it, but you didn't even go back and talk to the Phoenix Suns or
we
players.
We didn't talk to TJ Warren.
Yeah.
You literally had a guy.
How is this guy as a coach? He would have told you immediately, run. I mean, it's crazy to think that they didn't do their full due diligence. And here I'm the one that was sitting here. I was like, okay, we like the hire because on the outside looking in, the hire looks great. You know, he was part of some really good G League teams, and then the emergence of Toronto. I mean, it's one of those. It's like, yeah, it looks great, but now that this report's coming out, and you know, one of the assistant coaches that quit back in February, it now makes more sense. You know, he quit because of personal health reasons. Yeah, his sanity, apparently. or the fact that the coaches had to calm Nate Bjorken down. And like when they were flying out of Indy one time and the charter flight was delayed and he just blew a gasket. He just blew up and somebody finally told him they're de-icing the plane. It's a matter of safety. They can't take off. Like, that type of stuff, if that's the type of stuff that sets you off, that's not good. And I mean, if you read more into the article, the people say that, you know, walking around the front office is like walking around on eggshells. And that's not good. That's not a good workplace because nobody feels comfortable doing their job then. And I don't know. This is totally not what we've come to expect from the Pacers. I mean, there's been some bad coaching hires in the past. Isaiah Thomas comes to mind as another one, but it's just because they were bad coaches and, you know, right. they didn't get the most out of their players, but nothing like the players, like everybody just can't stand the guy and is afraid of him. You know, I don't know. It's not the way the NBA works. Well, that's not a way a lot of workplaces work these days. You know, you can't be that guy that sits in your office and screams at your employees and then expects them to perform at a high level all the time, because that's not the way it works anymore. So yeah, yikes. And the fact that TJ Warren came out immediately and requested a trade. And then, so his injury now makes sense. Why a lot of these players are injured frequently makes sense. Why some of them have shut it down makes sense. It's rough. Yeah. And it's not looking, honestly, right now, the best thing for the Pacers would be if they lose out. In order for them to really miss out on the playoffs, they need to lose tonight to the Cleveland Cavaliers. I don't know what the score is right now. They started about 2 hours ago. But they need to lose to the Cavaliers because they're not beating the Lakers. They're not beating the Bucks. And I know they have one more game, and it's against the Raptors. They need to lose to the Raptors. Honestly, they need to lose out.
As of right now, the Cavs are leading 60-53. That was 30 minutes ago, so probably into the third quarter now.
Oh, that means the Pacers are going to fall apart. Okay, good. Good. Because the best thing that could happen is they miss the playoffs altogether. And right now they're in 11th in the draft picking order and worst records. And they're only like two games removed from like the ninth spot. lose out, miss the playoffs. Playing in this play-in tournament would be honestly the worst possible scenario for them. Because, yeah, you're probably going to lose to the Wizards again. You haven't beaten them all year. And the way Westbrook is playing right now, you're not going to beat them. And you're not going to get a top 10 pick. I think having a top 10 pick with a new head coach is the best case scenario. Heck, if you wanted to move up, you've got a top 10 pick that you can bundle with like a Miles Turner or whoever you want to bundle and move up even higher. You know, there's a lot more options if you just miss the playoffs. You know, and I know the Pacers aren't one to tank. You're not really tanking. It's four games.
Yeah.
That's not tanking. That's doing the right thing for the situation at hand.
Right.
And I think the fans would be very okay with it now that we all know, like, oh, this makes sense. Now, okay, I get it. I understand why this year has been such a train wreck. It right. makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, now I think, and that kind of, you know, goes greatly into, you know, kind of my point in the next question here, which is there anything that can save Bjorkgren? Obviously, you know, I don't think there's anything as far as you are concerned that can save him. I mean, because even if they make the playoffs and advance out of the play-in tournament, they're going to be a first-round exit. You know, finishing the season with another first round exit and the locker room drama will be enough to lose Bjorkgren, his job. Cause of course he's brought in to, you know, obviously buck the trend of getting swept in the first round and not really, you know, getting back, you know, getting out of the first round of the playoffs. So, you know, all that and all the drama. And yeah, I mean, the great thing about this Pacers team, even, you know, with all of this, is that they still have a lot of young talent. They still have a lot of young pieces. So I think this is just, I mean, I think Herb Simon's going to make sure that Kevin Pritchard stays, you know, a little bit longer. He's loyal to him. That's what, you know, yeah. I read in the article. And I think, obviously, I think Pritchard will now be on thin ice because
he's going to have to nail the offseason.
Right. So, I mean, we'll see what happens there, but this is a situation, especially catching it so quickly. Like if the Pacers front office had gotten Bjorkgren and then, like, let's say we're having this conversation, like, let's say this is an article that breaks like in 2022, 2023, 20, whenever, like that's where it will be. Like, I would imagine that like everybody's gone. They're starting from square one, basically. You know, Bjorkgren is essentially, you know, Ryan Grigson, TJ Warren out of town and DeMont and Sabonis out of town and all that stuff. So now they still have, I think, such a good core and such a good, base of a roster to work around that I think that, you know, just
they can dig themselves out.
Right. They can just, you know, cut, you know, cold turkey away from Bjorkgren, hire a new head coach, hopefully nail it next season, and then pick up right where they left off. So I do like that. I do think, I mean, obviously from a draft pick standpoint, you want them to lose out. From a morale standpoint, I think, you know, getting, you know, a couple of wins in that play-in tournament would be nice. But other than that, I mean, yeah, it's just kind of salvage what you can, cut all ties with Bjorkgren and run it and come back next year.
Yeah, I don't think there's any chance Bjorkgren is back next year, especially after this damning article that came out. You can't. You know, the fans will be like, what are you doing? Why are we bringing him back? Nobody wants to play for him. Nobody wants to work for him. So why are we going to even try to give you our money to come watch this dumpster fire keep burning? I think that's the move they're going to have to make. This is where things could get interesting, though, with a new hire. I believe I'm just going to throw this out there. As an idea. This could be a potential move to try to grab Brad Stevens. Things are kind of stagnant with the Celtics. Now, this is the argument a lot of IU fans made as to why he should be the new head coach for IU. Things are just kind of getting stale with the Celtics. There's not much movement there. A change of scenery. You know, you can work. Okay, we'll trade you we'll give you our second round pick this year, or a couple second round picks and some cash considerations, or, you know, we'll give you this bench player as well. You know, you've seen those types of things where they make trades and compensations for coaches that are under contract already, which is a big difference than like you see in the NFL and other places. But I think that could be a move to be talked about or thrown out there, obviously. Is that going to happen? I don't know. Maybe not. It's just an idea. I think it would be, honestly, the best move for the Pacers because, one, you're bringing back somebody that everybody in the state loves. There's already talk that the Pacers may still try to acquire Gordon Hayward again this offseason because the Hornets really want Miles Turner, and there's the trade machine is working. So you could get Gordon Hayward back in Indy with his old college coach again, back in Indy. From a PR standpoint, it's a great move that the fans would really buy into. And this is a guy that you know is a polar opposite of Nate Bjorken, Bjorkman,
yeah, right?
Whatever, Borsch. I don't know. But hey, I mean, this would be a move to show the fan base, hey, we're serious about winning. This would show your team, your players, we're serious about winning. So here's a coach that, you know, has gotten his teams to the conference finals. He's a coach players love to play for. You never hear any bad things about the relationships with his players. You know, it's just players move on because they want to win more. Those types of things. And he's a really solid basketball mind. He gets it. And he's going to put butts in the seats because people in Indiana love him. They love them some Brad Stevens. Because of the magic surrounding him from his time at Butler, I think it would be a great fit all around, even if you don't get Gordon Hayward back. That's, you know, whatever. But just bringing in somebody to show the fan base, to show the players, hey, we hear you, and our cards are all in. We're all in right now. So that's the type of move they need to make to really – buy back everybody, because right now as a fan I'm like, this is a dumpster fire. Show to me why I should care. Why should I care?
Right?
If you do not get rid of Nate Bjorkman, knowing what's going on behind the scenes, I'm gonna care even less,
right?
To be honest. And it's like, players don't want to play for him, people don't want to work for him, so why am I going to spend my hard-earned money to go watch him coach a team that doesn't want to play for him?
Right?
No. So,
yeah, I mean, hey, there's a lot more of a reason for Brad Stevens to leave Boston for the Pacers than it would be for Brad Stevens to leave the Pacers or really the Celtics for IU. So I do like that thought. You know, the names that were thrown around in the article that they like talked to last year, you know, Mike D'Antoni, Becky Hammond from the Spurs.
I would love Becky Hammond as well.
Right. See,
I don't know about Mike D'Antoni. I do not know about Mike D'Antoni.
I'm not super, and I think the Becky Hammond hire would be good. Just also another great like PR, you know, move as well.
But that might be one where if I'm going after somebody at this point, I'm going after somebody now that's had head coaching experience.
Yeah, true.
Because
I mean,
on this one big time. You whiffed next, on it. And now is Becky Hammond like a Nate Bjorkman? Hell no. I mean, she's a Greg Popovich.
Right. That's what I was going to say is that like
up underneath him. And if you want anybody to model yourself after, Greg Popovich is the guy that you want to model yourself after. I mean, talk about a player's coach. You never hear a bad thing about Pop from anybody. Everybody loves him. I mean, come on. So I think Becky Hammond's, if you're going to go after somebody that's younger, and no coach, doesn't have the head coaching experience, but you know, a different mindset, Becky Hammond's would be the way to go. Cause even her teammates loved her when she played in the WNBA. She was, I mean, awesome. I wouldn't be surprised if she gets an opportunity in the WNBA soon. Maybe she doesn't want it. Maybe she wants to stay in the NBA.
Oh yeah. Well, I think she's close to possibly getting an opportunity in the NBA. It's just a matter of, you know, when, but
if I'm her, I'm hanging around the Celtics until Pop hangs it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is that, like, I've brought this up a few times to some of, you know, my friends, and they've been like, oh, well, you know, You know, she, why would they, you know, not, why would she not stay and take over for Pop? Like, why is she the heir apparent to Pop? But also, I mean, you know, we thought that, you know, there's been a few, you know, coaches that have done that. You have the opportunity now, you know, make your way to a, you know, team like the Pacers, you know, that, you know, has a good young core around, you know, there to, you know, build off of. I mean, you know, heck, we've seen other, you know, possible heir apparents leave, you know, whether, you know, be other sports or whatever. So I think it'd be interesting. They obviously need to move on from Bjorkgren, and it'll just be interesting to see how they end up.
What you need to do is you need to find yourself another coach type that is similar to Frank Vogel. Because push comes to shove, you should never have gotten rid of Vogel. I know his voice was getting stale in the locker room, but guess what? I don't think that was really him. I think that was just Paul George wanting out of Indiana.
Probably.
To be honest, that was guys just tired of Indiana. And I don't think that was Frank Vogel. You should never have gotten rid of him.
Nope.
So that's why I feel like Brad Stevens is the guy you need to go get, because guess what? If there's anybody that's like Frank Vogel, it's Brad Stevens. They've had a very similar career trajectory as far as like the way they've come up. You know, I mean, Frank Vogel was a former video like intern. Brad Stevens left a six-figure job at Eli Lilly to be a volunteer assistant coach at Butler. I mean, both guys came up from the bottom and
now they're here.
Yeah. Started at the bottom. Now they're here.
Exactly.
And Vogel's lifted the trophy.
Right. Exactly. And now I'm glad you said that, because real quick before we sign off, I just think it's honestly, you know, we talked a little bit about the play-in tournament. We talked about Vogel, who's, you know, lifted the trophy with the Lakers last year. I think it's hilarious that there was a report that LeBron is trashing the play-in tournament, just from the standpoint
they have to play in it.
Right, exactly. It's this. I said this to Chris Simmons of the MCT podcast on Saturday. I said, you know, he reminds me, as someone who has been commissioner of a couple of fantasy, you know, football leagues, a couple of fantasy baseball leagues, LeBron is the, you know, fantasy football manager that like you put out a post as commissioner, like at the beginning of the year, hey, these are the rules, read over them. If you have any issues, come talk to me. And then he's the guy that comes to you in week eight and is like, why did this happen? Why did this turn out the way that it did? And you're like, it was in the rules. Did you not read the rules at the beginning of the year? Well, yeah, but I didn't think it would apply to me. Like that's what it comes off as. Because
even last year, LeBron was like, I think this play-in tournament's a great idea. This is perfect. Right. You know, it allows more teams an opportunity. As he's sitting in the one seed. Now this year they're sitting at the seventh seed. And he's like, I hate this. This is a terrible idea. Why would you ever do something like this? This is a horrible idea.
Which also,
if you lose one game, you're bounced.
Right. Which also, like, I don't think it's not like he's switching, you know, takes on a topic that I think is split. I think most people like this, right? Most people like the play-in tournament. So it's not like he's changing sides on, you know, a debate that's, you know, kind of 50-50. Like, most people like it. I like it. I think it's a great idea. You know, as someone who doesn't usually pay a lot of attention, you know, to the NBA playoffs, you know, pays enough, but not, you know, a ton, you know, this is a great addition to kind of get you fired up.
Early rounds are just horrible.
Right. It's a game seven mentality from, you know, the drop of the, you know, drop of the hat. So I like it. I just thought it was really funny that LeBron, you know, all of a sudden is against it because he's going to have to play in it.
Yeah. I also do believe that people are getting kind of tired of LeBron. I know, maybe I am. It's like,
Space Jam 2 better be good,
bud. You
don't
need to have an opinion on everything. You're allowed to have an opinion. I'm okay with that, but the way you believe that everybody hangs from every opinion you have is starting to get a little old. And then the whole flop, you know, it's always been with the flopping. I really love watching LeBron play when he was younger, but the whole flopping thing is just really like, it's gotten bad. It's like, oh boy. Like when he played for the Heat, I loved watching him play. I loved the battles between him and the Pacers, and I thought that was great. I think ever since he got to LA, really.
Right.
I don't like LA LeBron. I don't like LA LeBron whatsoever. I think LA LeBron is a sellout.
Yeah, but I mean, Space Jam 2, it better be good. We'll see. All right, that'll do it for this week's edition of the Crash Course Podcast. Thank you guys all for tuning in. Make sure you go and follow us on Twitter at Crash Course FM. Like us on Facebook, Crash Course Podcast. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel, 3C Media. I was going to say it the first time around, but you guys have absolutely been killing it on the support. The last three podcast videos that we've put out have been in our like top 10 as far as recent videos go, as far as viewership. So thank you guys all for going over there, supporting the channel. Happy with those numbers. Also, you got the MCT podcast, which is our YouTube exclusive that comes out every Saturday. So you guys can be on the lookout for that. We're at 31 subscribers. We're on the road to 50. So let's get there sooner rather than later. Twitch.tv/3cmedia is where we record the podcast live every Monday. So make sure you come over if you want to give your input. As Dusty has, most weeks actually, on the podcast coming in, asking us some questions. If you want to, ask us a question, give us your input, head on over to twitch.tv/3cmedia. And remember, you can listen to us every week on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever podcasts can be heard. You can hear the Crash Course Podcast. We'll have more NBA next week as the playoffs are getting underway. We're going to talk some IndyCar as well. It's going to be a lot of fun. Hope to see you there. But until then, have a good week, everybody.